Hi everyone, my name's Derek, I'm an addict. It's a super buzz to be here. I'm a shocking groupie for NA, and I have to say I did not see that coming. I'm going to give a little bit of background as to why I ended up in the rooms and a couple of things, and then I'm going to try and stick with the principles. So thanks, obviously, to the convention committee. I know the work that goes into putting on conventions. Thank you, Andre. There you are. Dude, I was looking at you on Friday night. It was just oozing out of you, you know, the feeling we get when we get involved in this thing. And my, how I got here. I was born in a kind of upper middle class suburb of Sydney, and I had two loving parents, but I was different to my brothers. And, I was 5 years old the first time my mother was called into the school. We were Catholics. You know, I'd learn about principles and all of that. But the problem for me is, I had extremely poor feelings regulation, and I think it's classic with most of us. Anyway, I was 5 years old. I'd had a feeling about something. It was a tiny little Catholic school, kindy, first and second class, and I had a feeling about this project we had to do, and apparently I had snuck into the head nun's office during little lunch and got out the scissors and chopped up everyone's posters. Now, I don't remember doing it. There was no one else in there. I can remember scissors and I can remember the posters. And I think I just had, emotional, like a blackout. And that was kind of like a metaphor for my life. And as I got older and, when I was about 10 or 11, I made a conscious decision to be one of the good guys, and I was going to be class captain. My best efforts ended up, in fact, with me roundhouse writing the current class captain, literally off his, like something out of a fucking cowboy movie. I can't fight for shit, but if I lose my temper, anything can happen. Anyway, literally off his feet into the arms of the oncoming, deputy principal of the school. So I got to make class captain anyway. When I was 13, the headmaster called my mother into the school and said, if you want your little darling to finish school without a heroin habit, you need to move him now. And I got sent to private Catholic boarding school. They bent rules to keep me there. And I can best to describe that whole experience as I punched a lot of people in the face. I never saw myself as being violent, but that's what violent people do. And, I would just have an overload of feeling, an overload of fear, and, I'd just lash out. And anyway, they bent rules to keep me there. And I think the time I was there for 3 1/4 years, and I think it was like one of those, toy aeroplanes with the rubber band. It was just winding up and winding up. And I actually started dealing drugs before I left boarding school. This is pre-pagers, pre-mobile phones. I was just fully committed to that thing. I think the escape just promised me so much. I just loved everything about it. Anyway, I don't want to get into a drug-a-log, but, I left that boarding school, and within 6 or 7 years, I was on death's doorstep. My holiday destinations were basically the Golden Triangle, and that's where I went. And I sort of, do business there. I used to take. Oh, really? My story's actually horrible, actually. And I was a massive twice in my using. I was looking at 20 plus years. I'll wrap it up with this. I had 2 years where my drug of choice worked spectacularly, and I felt like Jesus' son all day, every fucking day. And I got to tell you, not God and all his angels. The first time, I know our book says we didn't become addicted in one day. For me, with that drug, it was everything in my body, every cell in my body was committed instantly. And, anyway. I had 2 good years. We were nice to each other. I had good connections. I never had a job in my life. I was a career drug dealer, user, and I had 2 good years, 2 not-so-good years, and the last 2 years were just absolutely terrifying and terrible and like gutter rat stuff, you know. And anyway, I went to my first meeting in 1975 and I was on the run from customs. I'd robbed some people and had a whopping habit and I was in a world of trouble. God bless my mum. She ended up in AA, probably because of me. Not really. I know she has her own disease, but her story was completely different to mine. You know, she raised four boys on her own and one of them was completely insane and that was me. And, you know, she did a great job considering. She had no idea she was alcoholic until, you know, her doctor, you know, told her, look, Evie, you've got stomach ulcers, you're going to have to stop drinking. She's fine until she tried to stop. And then all hell broke loose and she struggled for a few years. And, you know, I'm glad my mum was struggling in active alcoholism when I was running around in Asia and kidnapping people and God knows what, you know, just, you know. And I'm a dad. I cannot tell you how grateful I am my daughter does not have my condition, you know, and it happens a lot. I know people in the rooms who decided never to have kids. They didn't want to take the risk that they, you know, would be passing on the gene we have. It's fine if you get recovery, but even getting recovery, it's a struggle. I don't know about you. I would not wish my early recovery on my worst enemy, and I have hated some people. I don't hate anyone these days, but, you know, even at my worst. And anyway. 1977, I was 23 years old and I still had access to quality and quantity and I was out of control using, you know, and it stopped working. I had no idea that that could actually happen. I was in a world of trouble and I actually worked step three, which is a spiritual principle. I had no idea. I'd been to a meeting in 1975 in this private hospital. The only reason I went there was I could get replacement therapy without registering with the government. The people that I had robbed would not know where I was. And there was another reason, I can't remember. Anyway, and I went, you know, I sat in a little in-house kind of AA meeting and nothing. And, you know, I had a psychiatrist there and I remember him talking to me about my relationship with my mother and this and that. And I intuitively knew it wasn't my mother's fault. I also intuitively knew that I did not know why I used the way I did. I intuitively knew that he did not know why I used the way I did. I also intuitively knew he did not know that he did not know. But I knew he didn't know. And you know what? Even if he did know, this is my disease and this is how it works. Even if he did know, I wasn't hearing it because the drug was still working. At 23, which was 2 years after that, it literally stopped working and I was fucked. And I knew it, and I had never, ever, this was 1977 in Sydney, I had never, ever seen anyone that used the way, I saw lots of people use the way I did, but I never, not one, stop and turn their life around. They were all dead, they were in psychiatric wards, or they were in prison. And if they were lucky, they were in prison in Australia and not in Asia. And, you know, I handed my will and my life over to the drug squad. It sounds so, I look at it now, but that's exactly what I did. That's not how I looked at it then. I waited to get arrested. And I've got to slow down a bit. On the back of that decision, via, you know, I kind of pinballed around the place, I ended up in one of the very few 12-step based rehabs in Sydney. There were two. One was run by the Salvation Army. And look, they do an amazing job. You know, they're a real charitable, you know, they do all the man care, picking up people that, you know, they do an amazing job. But with the addicts and the program they were running, they were very keen to tell you what your higher power was. And they were very keen to get you at the end of their program with a tambourine in your hand. And it's funny. But that's why it's so important that drug addicts carry the message to drug addicts, you know. I was very resentful to that. Yeah. You know, because we know it's our life, you know. It's about eight different tangents I could go off on there. Anyway, I ended up in one run by this greasy old 9.5-fingered, very poorly dressed, I might add, Scottish alcoholic. And I cannot tell you how brilliant this guy was. He literally saved my life. I don't think, as I'm a founder sort of member of NA in my town, and NA had several starts in Sydney, not in Melbourne, but in Sydney. And anyway, and like a lot of people, like Ted, and when you mentioned Ted, you know, he was a good friend of mine, you know, and I'm really here because of Ted. I've got posse here because of Ted. Basically, Ted introduced me to his posse here, and yeah, he was a beautiful cat, and I miss him dearly. And that's a big change in recovery. You know, people were things I could use before I got here. Now people, I just adore people, you know, and I didn't see that coming either. Anyway, I went into this guy's rehab, and the day I arrived there, he sat me down. This is 1977, it's so far out of his time. He sat me down, he looked me in the eyes, and he said, "Derek, you're not an addict because of your childhood. You've got the disease of addiction, and you will never be able to drink or use drugs successfully again." I just wanted to stab him in the throat, you know. But having said that, 2 days later, 2 days earlier, I'd waited to get arrested because, in fact, exactly what he had just said to me, I in my heart knew. And so the process of, God, I look back, this was a five-bedroom house in one of the outer suburbs of Sydney, 45 junkies and this old alcoholic. And he saved quite a few of us' lives. He used to take us to AA meetings. And he said, "When we go to these meetings and you listen to the little old lady talking about drinking herself to death, you need to understand that drink is not the problem. And heroin and other drugs is not your problem. You have the disease of addiction." I got to tell you, I just, you know, it's not like I went, "Oh, great, thanks for letting me in on that secret," you know. I was not. You know, we talk about spiritual principles and the three that are indispensable. You know, I love our literature. It's so simple. It's very unambiguous. But there are three things that are indispensable: honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And I had none of them. I didn't even know what they fucking looked like. And, you know, I struggled. And I was in that rehab for 3.5 years. And, you know what's funny? My oldest brother, who's a civilian, how he would describe me is, he said, "You're a kind of eat the ass out of an infested rat kind of junkie," you know, fairly unambiguous. Anyway, he came to visit me when I'd been in there 2 or 3 weeks. He said, "How long do you think you'll stay?" I said, you know, being what I thought was lenient, 3 months. He said, "I think you need to stay 3 years." And in fact, it took that long. It took what it took, you know, and I had several rock bottoms leading up to actually my clean date, which is June the 6th, D-Day of all things, 1979. And, yeah, amazing. Yeah. Yeah, that's amazing. Oh, I pinch myself. I'm like an old guy now. I've been retired for 7 years. I have superannuation. I own my own home, like all these adult things. I honestly some days think I'm going to wake up and it was all a dream, you know. Right now, the dream is continuing and it is fucking styling. I am having such a ball here. I feel like a little kid on Christmas Day. God bless my dad. You know, he died when I was young and that didn't make me an addict. It may have accelerated things, but, you know, I had that, you know, thing long before, you know, he passed away. And, so I'm in this rehab and it took me, you know, I was so used to faking every fucking thing. I had no idea if I was faking things or not. I didn't know. And I remember he sat me down one time. So I'm talking about the principle of honesty here. And I heard, you know, Susie reads out the, you know, 200 principles or whatever. I'm suffering here. I think I'm going to need a couple of hundred years in recovery to get to that. Anyway, I have had to keep it simple, because I have a brain that will complicate everything. And why it will do that is so I don't actually have to do anything. And I'm this guy, God bless him, you know, he said 99% of the addict's confusion comes from the inability or just total unwillingness to accept the truth. And I thought, he's fucking right, you know. Anyway, who knew? He knew, and he was going to let me know. And honestly, you know, he had, I will be forever grateful for that guy. He also became the only, he's dead now, so it doesn't matter, but he also became the only human being I would cross the road to avoid bumping into. And, you know, it's not a humorous thing, you know, he went to prison for a real heinous crime. And, you know, in that rehab, he also wasn't part of the we. So I learned about the spiritual principle involved with step one. I'm fucked. I'm the one with the problem. I need to be part of the we. So I think, it, you know, 46 and a bit, yeah, you know, I might change my mind then. It appears to me the most important principle, the most important word in all of the fellowships, our fellowship, is literature, is the first word in the first step. If you don't get that, you won't get what we have here, you know, because, you know, the only way I've been able to keep it is like it says in our book, regularly going to meetings. And I've had to go with a capital R, you know. I got out of rehab after 3.5 years, and I'll backtrack a little. At one stage there in that rehab, they were having a group on me. They had a lot of groups on me, and I have to say, I got a lot of attention, you know. And in the end, you know, I got off on the attention, which is not good either, you know. I was very, very ill, and I was very dishonest, and I was, for a 23-year-old private school educated kid who had loving parents, I was a nasty, hope to die piece of work, you know. And I really, you know, I nearly killed people, just all the part of the disease. Anyway, I'm in the rehab and I'm learning, and I went in and out a few times. And I remember sitting in group one time, and he looked at me and he said, "Derek," he was calling me out about my personal honesty, which I look back now is just farcical. I didn't have any. And he said, I said to him, "David, I'm being as honest as I'm capable of being." Like that fucking meant something, you know. And he said, "Derek, unfortunately for you, your level of personal honesty isn't good enough to keep you clean. You will use again." And he was right, and I can see it now. But, you know, I had to go through those experiences to understand just how dishonest I was, or that was my process. And, you know, he really just did whatever he could in the short time he had us ram those fucking... Someone talked earlier about, you know, the tough love thing and at one of the meetings, and that didn't work for him. It worked for me, you know. And, so, you know, when I actually... The last time I went back into that rehab, I smuggled money in there and drugs. I didn't think it was going to work. I didn't know where else to go. I'd been kicked out for stuff that wasn't mine. It was actually stuff to do with the boss. He was doing a thing, you know, what we call 13-stepping. Everyone knows what that is? No? Yeah, you do. Anyway, if you were a good-looking girl in that rehab and, you know, you wouldn't sleep with him, you got kicked out. And if you're a bloke and you mentioned anything about it, this might be more about how mad I was at the time. A friend of mine's girlfriend said, "I'm out of here. He wants me to be one of his special girls." And sorry, I'll try and slow down. And, you know, I went and fronted him about it. And I got kicked out. And anyway... They were going to mutiny in the rehab, and they rang and let me back in. And you know, that last time I was in the rehab, I got to do step 4 and 5, and it was like the sun came out for the first time. Now, everyone talks about it's not scary and this, that, and the other, and it wasn't that scary. I was fully up for doing it, and I was in rehab in a stable environment. I had a peer group, but there was stuff in there that was uglier than I really deeply, you know, knew. And but I also, what it did for me was it reaffirmed step 2. I was clearly insane. No one in their right mind would do the things that I did. You know, obviously we're not in our right minds. We come to meetings on a regular basis in the vain hope that one day we will be. And, you know, I feel in my right mind a lot of the time now. I want to let newcomers know that it might be slow and arduous, and if you're like me, it probably will be, but it is a reality. I haven't hit anyone since I got clean, and I worked for a living. These are the two biggest miracles for me. I know I live on planet Earth, you know. People work for a living. I was never fucking going to be one of them. Anyway, I am. You know, I knew that stuff was over. And, so I got out, you know, I went and joined AA, and... about 8 months later, I was manoeuvred into starting an NA meeting with two other guys. NA had started and stopped in my town. So this is about spiritual principles, and it's the 12 traditions I'm going to talk about now. In the 1960s, we had a fellowship in Sydney that got to about 10 or 12 meetings. you know, I hadn't even started using then. I found out this by default, and from an old timer that actually turned up at an NA meeting in the mid to late 80s, and they didn't use the traditions. It fell apart. In 1972, it rebooted, and they called themselves Drugs Anonymous, and again, no traditions. And there were about five of those meetings left, and in 1975, they got in touch with Jimmy Kay and joined the Worldwide Fellowship. And but, you know, when I got out of rehab, I heard about those meetings, and, you know, they had government-funded literature. They had this book with ads for restaurants, and one of the ads was for Seba Geigy. That's the company that made Ritalin, and, you know, like, was sued for like $65 billion in a class action and lost, you know, anyway. And I just thought, fucking drug addicts, you know. A lot of us seem to have that thing of, you know, we'll go to the directions once we've ruined everything, which I think sometimes is a metaphor for active addiction, you know. But you know, we started a meeting and we just ran it by the traditions. And they used to call me like the NAPD, because I was scared. I was scared that it wouldn't work. And I've got a letter. I keep it on my phone for reference sometimes. And it's from Bill Wilson, the guy who wrote the 12 Steps for the other fellowship. In 1952, he's writing to a guy in Los Angeles. This guy is an AA member, and he'd been approached by the local, you know, women's prison to start a meeting for drug addict women. And he wrote to Bill, and Bill said, yeah, good idea. Don't do it under AA auspices type of thing, you know, whatever. And then he goes on to say, oh, I fucking love this. And he goes on to say, another issue you will have is this, that morphine and its derivatives seems to have made these otherwise fine people so phony, it's hard to find some moral ground in which to plant the AA program. And I have to say, I'm with Bill. That fucking absolutely, you know. But of course, you know, me and my two mates, we were perfect for the job. In fact, all of my history that got me to the rooms was absolutely perfect. I knew the addict mind, you know. And we started a meeting, we ran it by the traditions. And, you know, I've had two profound spiritual experiences in my life. You know, coming here, I'm feeling that same. But one of them was in 1978, I bounced out of that rehab. And in that other liquid fellowship, they call it, Ted used to call it NA Light, which I just fucking adore. I love that. Yeah, that's got, you know, that was Ted. And I miss the sound of his voice, you know. Fuck, I completely forgot what I was talking about then. Anyway, they had a line in their book about there are those poor unfortunates, those who cannot or will not be completely honest with themselves. And I got to tell you, pretty much everyone in the rehab, including the boss, thought I might be one of those, you know. But I was able to be taught how to be honest. And I remember he said to me one day, he said, your left hand hasn't known what your right hand's been doing for so long. This is going to take some work for you. And I did have a moment of clarity when I was in rehab. I looked at the 12 steps. You know, I'm apparently, according to the, you know, tests and stuff, of above average IQ. Anyway, I've hidden it pretty well. Anyway, I remember looking at those 12 steps and I thought to myself, fuck, I have based my whole modus operandi on doing the 180 degree opposite of that. So I kind of got quite defeated about that because I thought, Jesus, there is going to be work involved, you know, and I'm not a worker bee. That's how I saw myself. I work now, you know. I've been retired for 7 or 8 years and I run 19 prison meetings and oversee a couple. I've got I'm a H&I person, you know. I've done all levels of service. Yeah. That to me is the pinnacle of spiritual principle, you know. One of the things for all my bullshit, and I've been I've had all sorts of stuff in recovery. Here's an example. My first job, when I left rehab, that gorgeous older brother, and I have three brothers and I have good relations with all of them. And they're divine, they're oddballs, you know, but they're not addicts, you know. Five? Beautiful. Okay. Would you give me another nudge at 2 minutes? If you can, thanks. My brothers. I've forgotten what I was going to say. Anyway, that's right. So when I was leaving rehab, I'd been in there 3.5 years. I did more than the actual 3 that he deemed I should do. Anyway, he rang me and he said, oh, this makes me want to cry too. He rang me and said, come and work for me. I need someone I can trust. Anyway, I went and worked for him and, you know, I got to tell you, it was driving trucks and delivering flour, whatever it was. fucking hated it. I joke with my sponsees and stuff who were still in the workforce and stuff. Don't mention the W word around me. It triggers my post-traumatic stress. I'm damaged from having to work. Anyway, and it was funny, you know, someone mentioned the European delegates. You know, I'd be a European delegate. Anyway, if you can get that joke. Anyway, because of the program, I've been able to live and enjoy life as other people do, which means I could go to work. Anyway, maybe about after a year, he made me manager of that job and he went off and did other things. And, you know, so what did I do? I abused my position of management and gave all the shit jobs. And basically, I would sit in the office, you know, delegating, you know. And you know what? I couldn't sleep after a while. And it occurred to me one day, you fucking sleazy little fuck. If you don't, you know. So what I did was exactly what the program taught me. I got out of the office and I did all the shit jobs for 3 months. I had to make amends and not just apologize. None of my amends, and I've had some beauties to make, you know, have involved an apology only, you know. I made one amend. For a drug deal, you know, I clipped a guy for thousands of dollars worth of heroin, used it all, you know, went round. I was so mad, I've got to tell you, that I got to the rooms with 2 arms, 2 legs and no record and never done time and never copped a flogging is an absolute miracle, you know, and I know that that's God's doing, not mine. You know, I got caught in 74 in Thailand and, you know, some other things, and I was looking at 20 years for importing and crazy stuff. And you know, anyway, my disease flogged me though, you know, and yeah. So anyway, you know, I started to grow with that, but relationship, Jesus, I was probably 7 years clean before I was able to maintain anything like serial monogamy. I used to watch my friends getting married and I just think, I'd rather go to prison. You know, I was young and good-looking, and there was just a sea of good-looking girls in my part of town, and I just wanted all of them, you know. And I realised that, you know, the cutting-edge scientists call what they think they know what causes addiction, you know, poor dopamine reception in the midbrain. And they call it, I remember reading this article, I nearly fell out of my chair, and they call the condition reward deficiency syndrome. You know, so the problem I have is I've come into recovery, you know, and a lot of my dreams have come true. It's just not enough. I want all my fantasies as well. And I've half killed myself and others in recovery trying to pursue all of that in a full addictive sense. And, yeah, I'm so glad that, you know, I found the program. I'm so glad for that guy who carried the message to me. And it was a painful but blisteringly important lesson in it. It's the message, not the messenger. I could be using next week. It's not likely. I go to meetings on a regular basis. I heard someone talking about, you know, having a lot of sponsees. I have a shitload of sponsees because I just can't or won't say no. You know, someone asked me to sponsor them. I just think, what right have I got to say no? I got this thing. Very, very few of my friends crawled out of the drug fucked hole that I came out of and made it, and they're all in NA. It's like, I had my 45th year and a bit ago. I had five guys I was in rehab with come to my local meeting. You know, I have, yeah. I have posse, in Amsterdam. You know, a lot of them are in the room tonight. There's about 5 guys from my hometown and Sydney. Yeah. And one mad girl. Just kidding. And you know, I have sponsees in many, many different countries. even in Bhutan of all places. I'll close on this, and this is something about what the program has taught me. I was in Bhutan, and I've got lots of friends that are into Eastern mystics and Hindu and whatever, you know, and it's not my thing, you know. And I think, yeah, you can go to spiritual healing, you know. You could go out to the prison and maybe someone save someone's life, which is not about you, which of course is about you, you know. I was going to close on that. I've lost it now. You know, I've had to be heavily involved in service because my disease is just all over me. And if I'm not, you know, and so I am a good guy, but it's because I have to be. It's not like the Rotary Club, you know. I often like to think of the Rotary Club. I don't know if you know. Do you have that here in Europe? Yeah. So this way, like normal, well-adjusted people who are just lovely and want to give back to the community, not because their fucking life depends on it, but because they're beautiful people. I mean, I'm not saying I do get that love and that joy, you know. But it's because I have to, you know. I've had to do it, and I got, you know, thrown in the deep end of service, and I've done all levels of service, and I didn't have the option of doing what service I felt like. I had to do area service because there was no one else to do it. I had to do the prison service because there was no one else to do it, and it was the next right thing, you know. And I'll close, actually, I will close on this, and this is, in 1986, my grandfather died, and he was a good Catholic bigot, but, you know, he was actually a really good, good, good human being. And I used to go visit him. He was dying, he was 96 years old, and he said to me, "Derek, do you think you'll ever go back to the church?" And I knew in my heart I probably was never going to do that. What I did, and this amazed me, it really gave me super. Anyway, I went through each of the 12 steps and I broke them down and I explained them to him. And I got to the end of the 12 step and I said to him, "Grandpa, when and if I get finished those, I'll go back to the church." And he gave me this magnificent smile and he said, "Well, if you were to ever get finished with those, you probably wouldn't need to go back to the church." And I just thought, and you know, I did say I was going to finish on that. I'm going to one other line. I carry this thing with me for all my bullshit and defects of character and oversensitivity or whatever. You know, I have the ability to save people's lives. I can go into the prison, I can look people in the eye and I can promise them that if they put these principles in there, like that guy in that rehab promised me, if you put these principles into life, you can leave this prison and need never look like coming back. And the second promise, which I never dreamt, was, before you're halfway through these steps, you will not want to use. And that happened for me, step 4 and 5. And thank you so much to the committee. Thanks for everyone for having me.